And tonight's meeting is the evolution of mankind and the emergence of Homo sapiens. I'll hand over to Harry.
Yeah. Well, if I can make a slight correction, as you know, we dealt with the succession of life during geological time, and both these parts of tonight's talk were first of all separated. And the reason for the separation, they're really the subject of one talk, because it's a continuous process, but the reason for the separation was a question of time. Now, I'm going to condense it as much as I can. I'm not going to deal with the machinery of evolution as before, because that will be dealt with when I give the other talk, which is talk number 4 in this particular series, Darwin, Wallace and the Theory of Natural Selection and the Misrepresentations Thereof. So what I'm going to do is to give you factual matter and try and do the whole thing so that you've got a basic idea of the whole of the evolutionary process as far as man is concerned. And most of this took place in the Pleistocene period. You all know what Pleistocene period is because of, obviously you've... So most of you have been to the other talk, so you should know about that. Now, the primates, the word itself, I think, has a Latin derivation. It means first, but as far as evolution is concerned, it should really mean last, because the primates are the last in the evolutionary development. But, of course, what it really means is that it's the principle. They are the highest in the animal kingdom. So the primates are of a mammalian order, and they're grouped together because of certain anatomical structure. And the primates include apes, monkeys, lemurs, and tree shrews. And also, of course, anthropoid ape and man. Now, before I go any further, you can take a look at your ancestors. And you pass them round. There's about 3 there. Now, I don't know whether you know, but, of course, each order of mammals is defined by certain anatomical characters, and they are separated into various orders and suborders and families and genera and species. I won't go into a great deal of that, but merely to say that the primates are divided into 2 suborders, the prosimii and the anthropoidea. The prosimii are the tree shrews, the lemurs, and the tarsioid types, and the anthropoidea are monkeys, apes, and, in fact, man. Now, there is a further subdivision. The anthropoidea are subdivided into 3 superfamilies. The hominoidea, which includes man and anthropoid apes, the modern anthropoid apes, the Cercopithecoidea, which are old world monkeys, and the Ceboidea, which are new world monkeys. Now, the grouping together in the one category of man and anthropoid ape is called the Hominoidea, but the group to which the hominid line belongs to is called the hominidia. The hominoidea, of course, includes apes and man. But the division between man and apes is defined by the hominidia, which includes all kinds of men, and I'll explain what the criterion for that is, and the pongida includes modern and extinct forms of anthropoid ape. Now, there's a continuous process in this development, and the monkeys, which represent the lowest stratum of the anthropoidea which exist today, they're divided into two clearly defined groups: the Old World monkeys, or Catarrhine monkeys, and the New World, or Platyrrhine monkeys. And the significance of these terms is merely a difference in the disposition of the nostrils. That's all that means. Now, the continuation of development was on the basis that the tree shrew gave rise to tarsiers and lemurs, that gave rise to monkeys, and monkeys which gave rise to anthropoid apes. And the main factor in the way in which this took place was this, that it can be shown that the main changes which took place towards the development of man was an expansion of the brain, the shortening of the snout region, and limbs which developed a grasping and prehensile character, the change of the eyes from the side of the head to the front, giving stereoscopic vision, and the fact that the primates, in the first instance, were arboreal creatures. They lived in the trees, and these developments were determined largely by the necessity of being able to judge distances by sight, being able to hang on and grasp branches, and so on. And, of course, the main factor, the development of a larger brain enabling the animal to overcome difficulties by using intelligence rather than some specialized biological factor. Now, in order to give you an idea of how this occurred and the significance of it, I'd like you to hand this round. There's an illustration here of the head of a dog, a chimpanzee, and man. And you can see the kind of evolution that took place in relation to skulls. So if you have a look round there with that. Now, the earliest and most primitive monkeys or apes of which there's any fossil remains date from the Oligocene period, which is about 40 million years ago. And one of these is a small creature which is called Oligopithecus. And you've got to remember that most of these fossils, most of this knowledge is based upon fossils, and with, of course, quite a bit of detective work on the part of anthropologists, because the fossil record is far from complete, but most of the fossils of hominid and hominid lion fossils are composed of jaw bones and teeth and skulls, so that there's got to be and has been quite a lot of deduction, but nevertheless there's sufficient to be able to illustrate a continuous process in development. Now, there was a creature called Oligopithecus, and that had a dentition of a generalized character, and it's very important, the dentition, as you will see from one of those diagrams, which shows the dentition, I think, of a chimpanzee, of Australopithecus, does it? Or of a dog? Or what is it? It's an illustration of the way in which the canine teeth, for example, modifies as the progression takes place. There are modifications not only in the structure of the skull towards a bigger brain, but also in the dentition, there is a marked difference. There's another hominid, Parapithecus, which was found in the Fayum of Egypt, and this was about the size of a squirrel monkey. It was very, very primitive. It is suggested that this may have been in direct line with anthropoid ape of modern times, judging by the canine, the dentition, and the position of the canine teeth, the way that they had developed and so on. There were quite a few others. I don't want to deal in any great detail with these. You can ask questions on these. There are one or two different species. They were all about the size of a small gibbon, Propliopithecus, and this represents a stage further than Parapithecus in the line of evolution, leading to the anthropoid apes of today. And the anthropoid ape was just beginning to appear in Oligocene times, and there's quite a lot of evidence that in the early part of the Miocene period, which is probably about 25 million years ago, they had given rise to several different types, which soon spread far and wide over the Old World in considerable numbers. Now, in recent years, many remains of early Miocene apes have been discovered in Kenya. They range from creatures of the size of a small gibbon up to large apes, about the size of gorillas, and with many intermediate grades between the two extremes. And the one of the most interesting, there were a couple of species, Limnopithecus, Pliopithecus, but the most important of these was Proconsul. Now, there's a skull of Proconsul, and there's also a card which shows the artist's impression of what Proconsul looked like. And Proconsul was found in 1948. The skull is more primitive than that of modern African apes, and it shows some resemblance to Old World monkeys. But the fossil evidence which is available suggests that the earliest evolutionary radiation of the large anthropoid apes occurred in Africa in early Miocene times. And by the late Miocene and early Pliocene, they had extended their range considerably because their jaws and teeth have been found in deposits of these ages, or this age, in several places in Europe and India. There's a number of different genera and have been recognized from these remains. And the commonest form was Dryopithecus. That was an animal about the size of a modern chimpanzee. And also a smaller type, Pliopithecus, which was from the Miocene in Austria. It's suggested that this animal, the Dryopithecus, was an intermediate stage. The ancestors of all the modern large apes are close relative to the ancestors, and there's reason to suppose that this animal Dryopithecus may also be ancestral to the human stock as well. And there's a difference of opinion about this. Some anatomists take the view that the canine tooth was too large and specialized in the Miocene apes, and that the reduced form of canine tooth found in mankind indicates that the hominid line of evolution must have diverged from the pongid or ape line before this specialization had developed. On the other hand, the canine tooth of modern man shows definite traces of its derivation in the course of evolution from teeth of larger dimensions, so that some human beings, as you know, have a much larger canine tooth, but the structure, the pointed structure, as illustrated in this diagram, of course, has long since disappeared. Now, the The other discoveries which are important as far as these hominids were concerned, that is before man proper, as it were, comes into existence, there was one species called Kenyapithecus and Ramapithecus. They are both ascribed to the same genus, found in lower Pliocene deposits in Italy, and also extinct portions of a skull and skeleton of an extinct primate called Oreopithecus. Now, there's an impression of Oreopithecus, if you like to have a look at that. There's a lot of speculation about this because the remains of this animal was found that the fossil remains had gone through a hell of a process of pressure and so on, which distorted it considerably. So that there's nothing very definite about this, but it is assumed that Oreopithecus was a direct descendant, a direct ancestor, rather, of the hominid line. Now, one of the most important fossils in the emergence of Homo sapiens was the fossil, the Australopithecus of Africa. And this is a hominid which one could say was in a direct line of the development of mankind. It was, as it were, a demarcation point between a definite development of man and diversion from the anthropoidea in general, including, of course, the modern anthropoid ape. There's one or two diagrams here that you might be interested to look at in relation to Australopithecus. There's a lot of controversy, or there was a lot of controversy about this. The first specimen of Australopithecus was discovered by Professor Raymond Dart in 1925. And, of course, as probably you know, Raymond Dart was a subscriber to that school of ethology headed by Conrad Lorenz that introduced a new form. Conrad Lorenz and Robert Ardrey, Desmond Morris, introduced later on an idea which was based upon what has been agreed is a completely erroneous interpretation. However, that I'll deal with later on when I deal with another talk in relation to social Darwinism. But in 1925, this discovery by Professor Raymond Dart of Johannesburg, it was a well-preserved portion of a skull of a very immature ape-like appearance, and it was complete with a natural cast of the inside of the skull, which, of course, medical students will know as an endocranial cast. And it was complete with the whole of the milk dentition and also the first permanent molar teeth. They were also in position. And this specimen was embedded in limestone, which was derived from a cave deposit at a place called Tong. Now, I don't know whether I'm pronouncing that right. I don't speak Afrikaans, but it's spelt T-A-U-N-G. And I don't know whether I'm saying that right. But anyway, the fact is that was the name of the place, and it's called the fossil is called the Tong Child, because it was of an infant. This place is near the border of Bechuana land in South Africa. And Raymond Dart recognised an unexpected, as he thought, combination of simian features with anatomical different details of a more human character. And the age of this fossil was assessed in early Pleistocene times, which is as far back as 3 million years, but the age of this particular fossil was about 500,000 to 200,000 years ago. But many years later, many more skulls and jaws and limb bones of the same fossil group that was found by Dart were found also by Dart and Dr. Broom and Robinson of the Transvaal Museum. And these were recovered from limestone deposits. Many sites were considerable distance in the Transvaal apart, and some of them were well preserved. Also, of course, Professor Louis Leakey, the anthropologist that has done a lot of work at Olduvai Gorge in Kenya, the father of the present anthropologist carrying on the same work, Richard Leakey, who is the author of several very, very interesting books, not only on anthropology, but also upon the biography of Darwin and Wallace, which are well worth reading. And they recognise that all these fossils belonged to the same group. They were all Australopithecus or Australopithecina, but they were given various different names. I don't think I'll bore you with all the names of the subfamilies and all the rest of it, but needless to say that the general features are that the brain was comparable in absolute size with that of the modern large apes, about 600 cubic centimetres, which is about half the size of the brain of Homo sapiens, and a total structure, a morphological pattern, not found in any of the large apes, but which is distinctive of the hominidia. So that there were aspects and features which indicated that this could be an animal which was developing from an ape-like beginning to become more of a hominid. And there were further discoveries by Leakey at Olduvai consisting of hominid bones and teeth, given different names. Zinjanthropus, Homo habilis were two of the so-called different genera of this particular line. But it's evident that by the early part of Pleistocene, perhaps even earlier than that, the line of hominid evolution had led to the development of limbs approximating to the human type, even though the brain was still comparatively small. Now, the next most important fossil in this development was Homo erectus. And Homo erectus is considered to be a representative of true man. And the criterion that is used to define a true man is that he is a toolmaker. Now, it's quite true that there are other animals use tools. Chimpanzee, for example, will take a stick and use it as a tool to dip into a termite nest in order to get the termites, or they'll get a stone in order to break something open. But their application is very, very limited. And it's really only the hominid that becomes a toolmaker. And on that basis, Homo erectus, you may say, was the first definite man. Now, what occurred about over 80 years ago, a Dutch anthropologist, Henri Dubois, I think that his name was Henri, it might have been Francois, but nevertheless his name was Dubois, and he discovered in Java portions of a skeleton which aroused very acute discussion among students at the time. And these students, of course, were students of human evolution. The finds included a small cap and a thigh bone, the skull cap
might have belonged to a very primitive type of man, but it showed remarkable ape-like qualities or characters. It was in a general flattened shape. It had enormous brow prominences, brow ridges, and a complete absence of what we understand as a forehead. I'm feeling my forehead now. And the small size of the brain case. But on the other hand, the thigh bone, in its shape and proportions, was obviously adapted mechanically for the same kinds of stress and strains for which a modern human thigh bone is adapted. And on that basis, its owner evidently stood erect. That's why he was called Erectus, and walked much as we do today. The first of these animals, or fossil animals, fossil men, to be discovered was called by the discoverer Pithecanthropus erectus. And the word Pithecanthropus is a conglomeration of parts which mean ape and the other parts which mean man. So that it was an ape man with an erect posture. That's in fact what the term implies. However, it's since been accepted, generally accepted. There's no academic argument anymore in relation to this fossil. It's generally accepted that it was a true man, so that the name given to it now is Homo erectus. And of course there are various species and various genera which have been discovered in various parts of the world since the first discovery made in Java. Now, the brain case was about 900 cubic centimetres. An ape's brain case is about 500 cc's. A modern mankind is about 1,350 cc's. But there are extreme normal variations, as most people, anatomists and medical people will know, in cranial capacity in modern man, which sometimes give a normal brain of only 1,000 cc's. And this is largely, of course, in relation to the total structure of the body. So that the development, the most important development, took place, apart from the other factors that I've already mentioned, the stereoscopic vision and so on, was the development of the brain. But, of course, it's obvious that there was a development here towards bipedal motivation and standing upright, which was not necessarily in relation to the size of the brain. There were new discoveries in the Far East, and it was realized that these early hominids were not so different from modern man, not so different at all, so that they didn't warrant the distinction that had been given to them by their first discoverer, so that's why they were called, and still are, Homo erectus. Now, the time scale here, they existed 200,000 to 500,000 years ago. So you can see that the evolutionary process had very, very rapidly increased. And whilst there's been a progression from, as we ascertained earlier in a previous discussion, of some 3,000 million years, all of this process was condensed, more or less, apart from the development of the primates from the Eocene period and the Miocene period. It was all more or less condensed into the Pleistocene. Now, I have an illustration here of the skull of Pithecanthropus or Homo erectus, and also one or two photographs, Also, there's a you might be interested in a an artist's impression of what one of the Australopithecus species look like. So if you'll have a look at those, you might get something out of that as well. Whilst you're looking at that, I'd like to mention that there was another group of Homo erectus fossils which were discovered at a Chinese village called Chou Kuo Tien. And that's situated about 40 miles south-west of Peking. And it was in 1927 that excavations carried out in caves at this place under the direction of a Canadian anatomist, the late Professor Davidson Black. And this brought to light a single molar tooth of primitive human type. And on that basis, the anatomical features of this particular tooth was deemed to be sufficiently distinctive to justify the inference that it must have belonged to an extinct type of mankind. And they called this type Sinjanthropus, man of China. Needless to say that there were quite a lot of other fossils discovered at this site, and unfortunately, with the coming of the war, which suspended further operations, these fossil remains were packed up into cases to be transported to what was thought to be safety from the Japanese, and they were subsequently lost, believed to be sunk. And it was rather unfortunate that that took place, because there were a whole lot of fossils which were very, very useful. However, it doesn't make much difference to the general pattern, because they did take plaster casts before they sent them away. See, both these fossils, the ones found in Java, the ones found in China, are of the same genus. They're a Homo erectus, and incidentally there are quite a number of others, which we no need to go into because they are all of the same kind. I did mention earlier on in a previous talk that the highly technical processes to do with radioactive decay methods of ascertaining ages have been used on geological deposits, and it's been ascertained by that method that the Pleistocene began about 3 million years ago. And I did mention, of course, that it was earlier on that it was consequent upon a general lowering of temperature which led to the Ice Age, where you had four main glacial periods, and a study of the fossils in those glacial periods are all plants and animals which are adapted to a cold environment. And these glacial periods were separated by interglacial periods of a warmer period, and the fossil types were adapted to a much warmer climate. The Holocene, which is the present period that we were in, began about 10,000 years ago. Now, it's considered that this is an interglacial period. But nevertheless, for what I'm going to say further on, I'd like to mention this, that according to the provisional estimates, according to the general estimates, the first glaciation began about 600,000 years ago, the second about 500,000 years ago, the third about 250,000 years, and the fourth about 70,000 years. And the last glaciation reached its climax and began to terminate about 20,000 years ago. In Africa, it was a case of a pluvial and an interpluvial period, that is, a wet period and a period that was much drier. Now, fossil remains in these periods are quite hard to come by, but the way in which discoveries are made about man and what he looked like, apart from the fossil remains, is the associated stone implements that he manufactured. I'm not going to go into the differences in the actual artifacts, because later on I'll be dealing with another talk called Man the Toolmaker, where I'll go into some detail. But the fact is that the various types of artifacts which man developed during the first stages of his evolutionary progress, they are collateral evidence in the study of Homo sapiens. Now, there's no indisputable evidence, in fact, there's no evidence that I know of at all, of any manufactured implements from any deposits of Pliocene date. So that, as far as is known, for certain that is, they first appeared in the early part of the Pleistocene. And throughout the Pleistocene, stone tools were fashioned entirely by chipping. That's the art of chipping, and by grinding and polishing was not discovered until very much later, which is, of course, the in the period of the Neolithic period, the New Stone period. And that began about only 7,000 years ago. But the prolonged period during which the chipping technique was slowly developed and perfected is called by archaeologists the Paleolithic or Old Stone Age. And the early types of men or mankind who were responsible for its development are more often than not referred to as Paleolithic man, meaning Old Stone Age man. There are different groups of Paleolithic man at different times and in different places, and they tended to develop their own distinctive methods of chipping and flaking and to fabricate implements of characteristic types. And it's been possible to recognize and distinguish a number of different stone industries. And if you've been to the Natural History Museum, or been to, for example, the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, there are some very, very good examples of these different cultures. And, of course, they're known to be characteristic of a particular phase of cultural evolution, and in some cases to have been associated with a particular physical type of Paleolithic man. And it's possible to place these industries in a time sequence, a temporal sequence, even though, of course, one industry might overlap another, which is very often the case. I've got a chart here which is not necessarily a good one because it's not complete, but it'll give you some idea of the kind of thing that I'm talking about, because during this period of cultural development, and that's what we have to understand, because by this time, evolution, rather than being carried on by natural selection, it now began to be carried on culturally. And this will give you some idea of the affinities between the stone tools and the various periods. I don't want you to take too much notice of that, because I don't consider that to be very complete. I'll deal with that in much greater detail when I deal with man the toolmaker. There was a succession of Paleolithic industries. The Old Douan, which is a period of pebble tool development carried on by Australopithecus, and this was first discovered, as a matter of fact, by Louis Leakey at Olduvia Gorge from those deposits. And then there's the Abervillian or Chelian, the Acheulean, the Levalloisian, and the Mosterian, the Aurignacian, the Salutrian, and the Magdalenian. The Aurignacian period, there were many types of implements of very, very excellent design. And of course, these people, the Aurignacians, as they were called, they made use of other materials besides bone. They made use of ivory and horn and other similar materials. Then in the Salutrian period, this was characterized by pressure flaking, which is a technique far in advance of the ordinary chipping technique. And the Magdalenian, they supplemented stone implements by a great variety of other implements made from reindeer, antlers, and so on. And they also were able to produce magnificent and vivid polychrome paintings of various animals. Now, there is other evidence of a more modern man, fossil evidence. I'll deal with it very briefly. Heidelberg man, a jawbone, a mandible, was discovered at Heidelberg in Germany in 1907, associated with the bones and teeth of horses, rhinoceroses, antique elephants, and all these were from a former river deposit, and they date from the first interglacial period, with an antiquity of about 500,000 years. Three lower jaws, similar to the Heidelberg jaw, and showing resemblances to those of Homo erectus, were found at Terrafine in Algeria, and these were in association with stone implements of an early Acheulean industry. And a skull cap was found at Olduvia in the Middle Pleistocene, and Paleolithic tools of Acheulean type, and the age of that was about 500,000 years. And all these fossils suggest that the primitive hominids of the Homo erectus type may have been very widespread over the Old World during the Middle Pleistocene. And it's interesting to note the remarkable gradational sequence of fossils discovered in East Africa, because there's a time or temporal as well as a structural or morphological sequence leading from a generalized ape, proconsul, in the Miocene, to Ramapithecus in the Pliocene, to Australopithecus in the Lower Pleistocene, and to man resembling the Homo erectus type in the middle of the Pleistocene. And of course it may well be, therefore, as Darwin suggested very, very much earlier on more flimsy evidence than modern anthropologists have today, he suggested that the main line of hominid evolution actually took place on the African continent. There are other interesting fossil skulls. Three skulls were very similar. One was found at Swanscombe in Kent in a gravel pit. There were three skull bones, the occipital and two parietals, and these associated with rhinoceroses and elephants and red deer, and the implements were of an Acheulean phase of the old stone culture. And that was in the terminal part of the second interglacial period. Whether that means anything to you or not, I don't know. But there was found also skull number 2 at Steinheim in Germany, and this skull was found in 1933, suggests an anatomical link between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens. Number 3 was a cranium found at Eringsdorf, near Weimar in Germany in 1928, and this skull was associated with early Mosterian implements and with remains of a flora and fauna of a warmer climatic type. And its age, its chronological level can be fairly definitely assigned to the second half of the last interglacial period. There were other fossil skulls from the same period at Fonchi Chevard, if that's the right way of pronunciation, is it? Yes. Fonchi Chevard. Is that the right pronunciation?
Fonchi Chevard, yes.
Yeah. In France, Crapinia in Grotia, and at Mount Carmel in Palestine. There's something very curious about Mount Carmel because there's evidence of both Neanderthal and Homo sapiens, and I'll deal with Neanderthal in a few moments on and show you that there is a decided difference between that species and Homo sapiens. But nevertheless, it was in direct line of evolution. And there were skulls in South Africa discovered in 1932 at Bloemfontein, and a Galley Hill skull found in 1888 in the Thames Gravels, and also a skull at Bury St Edmunds. Needless to say, and I've dealt with this before, and I have a pamphlet on this, between 1908 and 1915, there was an elaborate forgery, which is known as the Piltdown Skull Forgery. And it was very, very cleverly done, but it was discovered largely by one of the members of the Department of Paleontology at the British Museum of Natural History, using the radioactive decay method that discovered the forgery. But that is of not any significance anymore. It was one of these things that happened. It shows, of course, that the methods that are applied can come up with the facts. That's what really shows. So that if you want that, I don't know whether I've got any. If you want that, you can get that at the British Museum. Quite an interesting story. In various other parts, the Great Rift Valley of East Africa, a lot of Acheulean hand axes, but no skeletal remains. And these were associated with an assortment of extinct mammals of about the Middle Pleistocene period. Now we come to a very, very important period of human evolution. In the Mousterian phase of Paleolithic culture, which followed the Acheulean and lasted in Europe during the advance of the last glacial period, right to its climax. And this was marked by the appearance of a very, very distinctive type of man. Now, this type of man is commonly called Neanderthal man. There are various specimens of Neanderthal man, but it's called Neanderthal man because it was discovered in a valley of that name near Dusseldorf in Germany. There was only the top half of the skull and a few ribs on this occasion and limb bones, and the skull differs very much from modern human skulls in the enormous development of the brow ridges. Again, a peculiar factor. It had a receding forehead and the flatness of the skull roof. And in all these characters, it's got a distinctly simian appearance. There have been various other discoveries. There was a discovery, of course, a well-known discovery in 1886 in Gibraltar. But these remains were not taken much note of. They weren't recognized at the time.